All right. Well, anyway, good morning, folks. Boker Tov, Shabbat Shalom. Welcome back. And let's talk about part two, if you will, of the Torah portion that really kind of lays out, I will contend, so much of what is wrong about where we are today and what needs to be fixed. And, of course, key in that discussion is the fact that it guides us in the direction that I will contend we need to go. And, of course, so does Moshe on that score. So this is called Ekev. I spent a lot of time talking about the meaning of that, and we'll do it just briefly again this morning. But it begins in Deuteronomy 7, chapter 7, verse 12. And just for purposes of completeness, we'll read it, because there is a really unusual word that's used there. It says, "And it shall come to pass," in the English, or "it will be caused," or "because of this, this will happen." Okay, so the key word in there is this word that appears in the second, literally the second word in the Hebrew, and this is where the Torah portion name comes from, Ekev. And people say, well, it means because, or it implies causality, a causal relationship. As you know, if you listened last night, it really has to do with the word heal. He will bruise her head, its head, the snake's head. Remember that prophecy from Genesis? And he will bite, basically, at the heel, Ekev. And she will crush the serpent's head, is one of the references. You recognize the... Hey, Ekev, Yaakov, right? Same root word, heel, because Yaakov grabbed at the heel. So here's another reference to heel, and you have to ask, what the heck does a heel have to do with because, or hearkening to anything, or some kind of causality? And, of course, there's lots of speculation on that. And I saw a particularly good one that goes into some detail. I'm not going to do the whole thing in detail, but I am going to mention a few of the key points that I think really kind of lead in the direction I want to go anyway today, because of this concept of because. It shall come to pass because you hearken. These ordinances, these mishpatim, these mitzvot, these hukim, these things that I command you to do. When you do all of that, when you shamar, when you hearken, when you listen and obey, then Yahuwah will keep with you the covenant, the mercy which he swore to your fathers. He'll love you, bless you, multiply you. All this good stuff is going to happen as a direct result. Another way of looking at the word is, this shall be the reward. That's how Art Scroll translates that Hebrew word ekev there. And the key is the following, and I like the way this is phrased. The Torah has selected this particular word to convey the concept of causation. And now it makes a little bit more sense when you think about it, causality. And as an engineer, I like this term, causality. We talk about all kinds of things in the physical world. This causes that. How do you know it's not just correlated, right? Does correlation imply causality? Therein lies part of the rub for today. If you do these things, good stuff will happen. Well, say people, maybe it just could have happened by chance anyway. What do you try to convince me that if I am walking in obedience to some God, that this good stuff will happen, or that these curses will happen if I don't? You know that I like Ecclesiastes 8:11, the argument that Shlomo, Solomon, makes, where he says, you know what? Because the consequences for an evil act are not visited rapidly enough, in other words, what us engineers call lag. There's a time delay between when you do something bad and you get punished. Everybody knows that if you're trying to deal with animals or train animals, you want the reward or the punishment. If you're going to use punishment, you want it to happen fast. If you tell a dog, he potties on the floor, bad dog, 2 days later, he's not going to understand. What has that got to do with what I did? You catch him in the act and whop him with the newspaper, right? Then it's a little bit different story. Well, people are the same way. Turns out that people that have been raised, and I will contend that's what's happening today, to be stupid, to not understand causality, to not know there's a connection between cause and effect, well, they can ignore the fact that there's this relationship here. And that's indeed, hey, there you go. In a nutshell, that's the whole gist of what I want to talk about today. We live in a world where the break has now been made complete between cause and effect. Don't understand what the purpose of the heel is anymore. That the heel steps first, then the toe follows, then the body and the head comes along later. Heel, toe, step, step, walk in obedience, head comes along. Sometimes the head leads, the head decides where the heel is going to go. It's a continuous loop, and it's a feedback situation. Here's another one of those nerdy things as an engineer. When we deal with feedback loops, And the cause implies the effect, which gets more of the cause, which causes more of the effect, which causes more and more. When it's a good thing, it's called positive feedback, everybody benefits. And it's kind of hard to know, because it's a continuous process. Well, what was the first cause and the first effect? You just keep doing good and better stuff keeps happening. It's, well, it's what happens with a free enterprise system, which is also part of the root of understanding where Torah is at. We'll talk a little bit about that today as well. Now, let me get back to this whole concept of the heel and why that particular word is kind of interesting in this. I'm looking at this piece that I mentioned already by Rabbi Noson Weiss. And he says it's about spiritual economics, this portion. It's about expectation-driven systems. Trouble is, they're double-edged. What does he mean? Well, as an engineer, I'd say if positive feedback, if it's a good thing that you're feeding back, positive feedback causes more good. On the other hand, when it turns around and starts getting negative, the positive feedback can cause a whole lot of additional negative too. In other words, the system implodes on itself. All right, let's get back now to the Torah-specific portion of all this. It has to do with Ikev and the heel. And I like this. He goes through a bunch of, famous rabbis, as you might expect in some of the Midrash. But look, in this case, the world and the word, Ikev, while it might have the root of heel, it's not really causation, it's not really heel either. All of this is about a deeper meaning. Essentially, when you look at this in context, this word Ikev is describing something that is used to encapsulate disparate ideas. You with me? Ikev applies to the heel, because that's the part of the foot that's a circular joint, connects the straight part of the leg with the flat part of the foot. And the idea of surrounding these separate, these disparate objects or location, putting them in a single kind of a box and closing them within a circular area is what we're really talking about here. That's what Ikev means. The circular enclosure of two separate parts of the foot. That's Ikev. That's the part that means causality. It shows us the relationship here. And furthermore, that's what we're talking about when we say that there are things that are enclosed within a singular enclosure. They're Ikev. So here's the bottom line. All right, I skipped over a whole bunch of text. Hopefully that's clear enough. The Torah selected the word Ikev deliberately, says this particular scholar and those that he's quoting, in order to teach us about the laws of spiritual cause and effect. If you do good, good things will happen. If you walk in obedience, there are blessings. If you walk in rebellion, there are curses. Spiritual cause and effect. And this unusual word, Ikev, was picked. Could have been other words that were used, but this one is all about defining this causality, this causal relationship. Now, that's really why I started with this particular story, because I think the causal relationship is key. Again, if a causal relationship exists, think about a functional family as opposed to a dysfunctional family. Mom and dad love the child. The child grows up to be a good child, and it demonstrates in turn love for the parents. And the whole system is self-reinforcing. It's a positive feedback loop. People do good, they get rewarded. Matter of fact, it works with societies, and that's part of the bigger point, right? You have a society like, say, the United States once was, holding certain truths to be self-evident, that men are created equal, endowed by, no, not the biggest brother you can imagine, but by one particular creator, the one that wrote the book for us, with certain God-given rights, including life, liberty, and property. People have freedom to worship him in the way that they choose, and we'll come back to that in a minute. And as a result, they have free enterprise, and there are all kinds of good things associated with honest weights and measures. And what would have been one time called capitalism, I don't like that term anymore because we don't know what it means. You can't have free enterprise or a free economy with dishonest weights and measures. You can't build, in other words, a free society on fraud. Well, what's happened is, what was once a free enterprise, God-fearing, God-obeying, and blessed feedback loop, right? Positive feedback society where people learned and did good things and had freedom to invest and to reap the rewards, and they built better and bigger things and they achieved great prosperity. Now it sounds like that line from the the preacher who wrote about the societies, you know, that have from abundance and prosperity, from obedience to abundance and prosperity and so forth. And then there's this failure that happens. Oh, well, we're getting to all of this. Okay? When we break the feedback loop, when we forget, well, that's what this portion says, when we forget the God who gave us liberty, gave us life, and we walk in rebellion, what was a positive feedback loop for good, and he describes that in some detail here, becomes a positive feedback loop for evil. Let me just go through a couple of these verses here to make this clear, because he says it. It'll come to pass, because you hearken to my ordinances, statutes, judgments, mitzvot, mishpatim, hukim, and you keep them. He'll love you, bless you, multiply you. All this good stuff's going to happen. No diseases, but do not follow after the gods of this land. That'll be a snare unto you. Don't be afraid of them. If you do that, you break the feedback loop. Bad stuff will happen. He warns us, and this is part of the key, and this is part of the real lesson here. When it comes to their graven images, burn them with fire. Detest them, abhor them, hate them. Don't even covet the gold or silver that's on them, because it, like them, are an abomination. And if you do that, it'll be a snare to you. Don't even bring this crap. That's a polite word, right? Abomination, to'iba in the Hebrew, is a far worse word. It's the worst word you could imagine to label something evil with in the Hebrew. Don't even bring anything like that into your house, lest you be accursed like it. You're to utterly detest it, utterly abhor it, because it's devoted to the wrong thing. So throughout this portion, example after example, time after time, he says, look, remember, teach your children, keep, walk in obedience, heel and toe, obey. Don't forget Yahuwah, your El. Don't let your heart be lifted up. Don't fall into the trap of thinking because this positive feedback loop of obedience and blessing, bringing more blessing and more obedience. Don't start thinking, I did this all myself. It's my hand and the power and might of my hand that have gotten me this wealth. If you do that, he says, you'll surely perish. You break the feedback loop. Another comment from this first article that I want to throw into the mix here, because there's a number of things. Trouble again with a feedback loop, positive feedback, good begets good, which begets more good, is that when it's broken and the loop no longer works the way it's supposed to and things don't build up. And by the way, you see this throughout the natural world, right? Crops that bring forth in abundance and you plant more crops and you have more abundance. Animals whose herds grow and grow. You name it, so many things in the natural world, if you feed them right, if you take care of them, if you walk in obedience, they grow and they grow and they bless you. It's a positive feedback loop. And yet when things fall apart, if we don't understand the process and we don't understand what this word ekev means, as a consequence of causality, why these things matter, we miss so much of the whole point. And with the example of economics, I want to go back to that again, because remember, Torah economics is real specific. If we understand Torah, honest weights and measures, what you end up building is a free enterprise society, like the United States once was. Fake gods, they'll tell you they're the ones that are going to allocate prosperity. You want the blessings of the almighty welfare state? Well, you got to toe the line to Big Brother. He will allocate. He knows better than you. He plays God. He will choose for you. The loop's broken, and the things that were built up by decades of obedience and prosperity and people walking in obedience to a different master, they fall apart. Does it happen rapidly? It can, but it tends to be over a period of time. Back to Solomon, right? Because the consequences for an evil act are not visited suddenly. People miss cause and effect. They don't understand. We've built an entire society today that does not even understand simple economics. So here are some pretty salient comments. Now this also sets up a lot of the things that are important to where I want to go today, having to do with literally the entire world and what has come apart at the seams and why. He says it this way. This is Rabbi Noson Weiss. We tend to equate God's rewards to kind of like a salary. And therein lies the problem. This is part of the reason we can get messed up. We think that if we do something, he will reward. Well, that's true. If we do something, he will reward us. But it's not always quite in the way or in the amount that we think. Right? Remember that famous song from Melanie? Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? I prayed for a Mercedes-Benz. Did I get one? Isn't that the way it works? God is like the great big candy vending machine in the sky. You pray, you send your money to the TV evangelist, and you get lots of dollars. That's the way it works. No, it's not. It's not like a salary. There is no direct cause and effect correlation. Not between, what you ask for. I did a good deed. I helped that little old lady across the street. Shouldn't I get $1 million? No, it doesn't quite work that way. And it's not the same with work and salary. You got a bunch of idiots that today say, well, this person does job A, this person does the same job, they should be paid exactly the same. Why? Because we are playing God. We know. Men and women, we should have equal pay for equal work. How are we going to do this? We're going to let the free market hand? We're going to let the idea of concepts of real economics dictate? No, no. No, we're going to mandate it. Communist style. There is no direct cause-effect relationship correspondence between work and salary. And this fellow points out, look at what assembly line workers at a major car plant might be rewarded. Every single car that gets built by a major car manufacturer on the assembly line is the result of the labor of those people. Shouldn't they get a proportionate? Well, that's fair. We'd say that's fair. But on the other hand, how about people that are involved in somehow or other, and maybe we don't understand, in the process, and their work doesn't build the car? Case in point, salesmen. You know that by and large, people that sell cars make more than the people that build the cars? Is that fair? That's wrong. We should mandate that that be different. Well, you know what? Pretty soon you're out of business. Because if you can't sell cars, doesn't matter how many you can make. Doesn't seem fair. Now, the point is, what works is the concept of freedom. And that, yes, it's true that individual people have a responsibility and their contributions to the finished product. They all play their parts. But here's what turns out to be most efficient. It turns out it's also consistent with Torah. Let people choose. And let the market and the freedom of individuals to decide how they want to spend their hard-earned real money dictate how the allocation works. Oh, sounds very complicated. All right. Well, the salespeople, though, their work doesn't produce any cars. It just generates money to pay the salaries of everybody else. Here's the bottom line, okay? There are skilled workers, there are unskilled workers, there's management, there's salespeople. All of these have an effect. Sometimes there are things that we find that aren't free anymore. In other words, yes, management can skew the results, and people can lie, cheat, and steal, and they can take more. And all of these things are, ultimately, they're all violations of Torah as well. But the reason we don't fully comprehend the bigger picture here is because most people, especially nowadays today, have no grasp of the laws of supply and demand that really apply to the situation, that really say how much a salesperson gets paid as opposed to an assembly line worker, as opposed to an engineer that designed the product to begin with. All right? Sometimes if there's an engineer that designs a really successful product and he becomes kind of a star, he commands a higher salary because people say, hey, that guy designed the Mustang. That guy designed, this really successful product. Just maybe he can do it again. Back to this idea of Ekev. And the correction of this mistaken impression. Rewards offered for the performance of mitzvot, he says. Now, here's what we're talking about. Let's make this clear. There is an economy in the world. There's actually multiple economies. You've got free economies and you've got slave economies, communist, fascist economies, and so forth. And I will contend that history and Torah are both clear. The free economies are much more productive, and they produce much more goods and value for everybody. There's a downside, too. We'll talk about that in a second. But ultimately, this idea of kev, of the heel and the toe, the feedback loop, the encapsulation of this whole feedback loop of blessings and obedience, is about building a system where the rewards offered aren't quite the same as we might be led to believe. So here's the idea, right? If a person who has been lied to about economics can't understand how the laws of supply and demand and free enterprise and people making choices via the invisible hand of Adam Smith, if we don't even understand that part of how rewards are based on the work that people do, how much more so if we've been told there is no God, his law didn't matter, it's done away with, it's nailed to the cross, none of that stuff matters anymore anyway, that's just superstition to begin with. Do you think, for crying out loud, that people are going to have any clue about spiritual supply and demand? About how it is that obedience can really bring rewards? Because, hey, you know, I prayed for the Mercedes-Benz, I didn't get it. Clearly, something is wrong here. Clearly, there are disconnects in the system, and there are more. And we don't even understand all of those until we go back and read the Torah and recognize that when this feedback loop is broken, when he says, look, if you bring fake gods in, if you start worshiping them instead of me, A, you're going to get kicked out of the land. Well, we have been. We are. We're still in exile. And B, if I hide my face from you, if I won't hear your prayers, right? He who turns his ear from hearing Torah, says Proverbs, even his prayer is an abomination. It's Tawiba. Well, no wonder people don't understand spiritual cause and effect either. They don't understand blessings for obedience because they just soon not live in obedience anyway. Once the feedback loop is gone and we're simply so far outside the system we can't even see it, well, no wonder. And here's where we are. So let me read this paragraph. This, I think, is pretty cool because what we're talking about here are things that people have trouble getting their heads around, and it's by design. We've been dumbed down to the point where we've been told God is dead, the Old Testament's done away with, all of that law that he wrote, that's all nailed to the cross. Whether we're talking about honest weights and measures, gold and silver, kesef, whether we're talking about obedience bringing blessings and rebellion being bringing cursings, whether we're talking about fake gods. Do you really think that we can honor Ishtar Sun God Day and have bunnies and eggs and think and claim that we're celebrating the death of Jesus on the cross when in fact nothing that he did had anything to do with pagan fake goddesses ever? As a matter of fact, the whole concept is anathema. And if we can't even understand something that ought to be that in your face and simple, like have no foreign gods before me, and don't go worshiping the gods of this land and saying I'm supposed to like it. Don't even bring an abomination into your house. Leave the chocolate bunnies and the eggs out of your house, for crying out loud. Is it any surprise that we have forgotten principles of, well, even honest economics and especially spiritual supply and demand? So, back to this idea of Ekev and what we're missing if we don't put our heads around what's being taught in this portion and indeed all of Torah. Rewards offered for the performance of mitzvot, right? You do these things. You walk in obedience to the Creator. Simple. They're there from the Ten Commandments to the, well, some number of them at 613 mitzvot and so forth. But there are blessings for obedience, rebellions for cursing. Rebellion brings cursing. It's a different kind of supply and demand. Blessings are thus the natural consequence of obedience, observance of his commands. And here's the line I like. The universe, ha'olam, right? The universe, whole world, was constructed. He literally laid these laws, these Torot, laws of gravity, laws of the immutable law that you reap what you sow, and so forth. So that observance alters reality. Now, this sounds almost metaphysical, doesn't it? But listen, observance alters reality in cause and effect terms to produce blessings. Observance of his mitzvot, of his commandments, observance is at the head of this reality, safeguarding the covenant, the things that he's put in place to make the whole process work, is at its foot, at its heel. What's hard for us to understand, and I can attest to this as an engineer. I worked for literally years. I got several promotions as a result of doing mathematical modeling of a closed loop system. How do you model and measure and test a closed loop system where the very thing that you put into the system affects the outcome, which in turn goes back and affects what you're putting in? This is part of the reason why I talk so much about beta tests, some of the nasty stuff that Big Brother is doing to model human reactions. They're doing the very same thing to the closed-loop system that is society. It's part of the reason why I get so angry when I see this and think, these scumbag, satanic, evil people, they're modeling human behavior and they're deliberately manipulating the entire closed-loop system that is society, that is the world economy. And what are they doing it for? They're doing it to serve fake gods. So let me read that line again. The universe was constructed by the Creator so that observance, walking in obedience, literally alters reality in terms of cause and effect to produce blessings. Now, that's very metaphysical. Sounds almost New Age. No. All right? How do you take a society where people don't trust one another and fix that? Let's do a real simple example. Some of you are old enough to remember, as I am, that there was a time in America when people simply didn't lock their doors. Anybody remember that? Yeah, I grew up in little suburban neighborhoods. We walked to school. I remember being 5 years old, kindergarten, walked to school with my buddy. We walked home. Hey, guess what? When I was 8, 9, and 10 years old, we carried 22 rifles to school, stacked them in the back of the classroom, went target shooting in the farm field on the way home where the farmer had a place for us. Trust was basically endemic to society. Why? Because we all serve the same God. We didn't hurt one another, and nobody was going to come and steal your kids, for crying out loud, and they didn't go in somebody's house without being asked. I could walk into my neighbor's house, open the back door, hey, Jimmy, you there? Come on in. Door's unlocked. Of course it is. You want to do that now? You want to leave your door? Well, see, if you have trust in your neighbor, you can leave your door unlocked. Well, you're going to be robbed, probably, in Chicago, in New York, and most of these places where God hadn't been welcome for years. Trust is a feedback loop. I trust you because you trust me, and it's a positive feedback loop. But the point at which somebody breaks trust and breaks in your house and steals, all of a sudden my trust is hurting a bit. It's going to take quite a while for that feedback loop to get reestablished. Let me read this again. Observance of mitzvot, in other words, walking in obedience to Yah. Hey, my word is my bond. I'm a man of honor. If I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. You can trust that. Well, once people realize you can, and you live in a community where that is, in fact, everybody's word and their bond, trust abounds. There's a feedback loop. Kids are safe. They grow up in an environment of trust. They trust one another. They learn to, obey and keep their word too. But once that process starts downhill, once that positive feedback loop becomes, you don't trust me, I don't trust you, I might just steal your stuff, we end up with, what looks like, in fact, most TV shows, most neighborhoods in New York City, Chicago, and you name it. Says this author, we're talking about expectations and consequences in human affairs. And if you look at economies, you can see that the same thing applies, right? If people have the belief that their hard work is going to be rewarded and that they can invest for the future and that their money is going to be valuable a year from now and that the investments that they make can yield rewards, well, hey, I'll build a new factory. I'll hire new people. I'll buy this new widget or that. But at the point where there's panic and mistrust, and they may steal my stuff, and Big Brother probably tax it anyway, they'll regulate me into non-existence, I can't actually benefit from putting new investments into my factory, why don't I just shut it down and move it all to Malaysia or China anyway? Hey, even if I made a profit, they'd come and steal it. Besides which, I can't afford to pay for Obamacare and stuff. Positive feedback loops. They work in both directions. It's a double-edged sword. So, on to the bottom line. This part of Ikev. Let me start this again from the beginning, right? If you will walk in obedience, it'll come to pass. Ikev, it shall happen. The causal loop. The causal relationship. If you hearken, or because you hearken. See, it's the same thing. If I hearken, well, I am hearkening. So if I hearken, I'll continue to hearken. It works, right? It's a continuing feedback loop. I do it today. That was good. I'll do it some more. And I'll get my rewards. And then the other people will see, and they too will do good things. It'll come to pass because all of it, everybody, begins to see the blessings. The reality is altered. They hearken to the ordinances, the statutes, the Torah. Yahuwah too will keep his bargain with the covenant. Love you, bless you, multiply you. All this good stuff will happen. What we're talking about here, folks, is what I refer to now. This is kind of a, hey, here's the bottom line. The Torah worldview. Most folks that are listening to this have, maybe we didn't come by it from birth. Maybe we had to have some hard knocks. I refer to it as the two before, that sometimes the creator of the universe winds up and whacks you right across the teeth with a two before and says, are you listening now? That's what it took for me. I'll admit that. Quite a while before I finally got back on track and said, oh, maybe I really ought to read his book. Maybe I really ought to start walking in obedience. But once you get there, it's a little bit easier, isn't it? Because the worldview is self-reinforcing. The more I understand that he is, in fact, a keeper of covenant, and that his word is true, the more I can see the truth of that. People that don't believe it, well, they don't have a Torah worldview. Their perception is different. Hey, you know what? Seems like I recall a fellow named Shaul writing, let this mind be in you, which was also in Yahushua HaMashiach. In other words, he had a Torah-obedient mindset. He had the kind of mindset that we should seek. And if we have that mindset, we can see it. We can walk in it. People say, oh, you know, you remember the line, right? Seek first the kingdom of Yah, and all these things will be added to you. Can you see how that fits? We're talking about a mindset and literally a different world. Now, I talk frequently about choice of law. Same difference. I can choose. I can choose to be part of the kingdom of this world, HaSatan's kingdom, his law. Guess what? Like other fake gods, he's capricious. He likes to screw with people just to make them squirm. So does Big Brother. Well, we're talking about the same thing. We're talking about fake gods. And the very nature of these fake gods, and you can look at all of the Greek and the Norse and the Roman mythology, they're capricious. They like to mess with people just because they can. Ha ha, I'm a god and you're not. Guess what, folks? We're talking about the TSA attitude of transportation sexual abuse, too. Which world do you want to be in? Which worldview? You want to be in a worldview that says, look, I trust my neighbor. My neighbor is a good fella. His word is his bond. I trust him to have a gun. You know what? If he wants to get on a plane, I know him. I'm perfectly happy. Let him carry a gun. We'd all be better off. Wait a minute. I don't trust anybody. I want to treat everybody like a criminal. I want to search everybody's gonads. I want to grope their children. I want to see them x-rayed and microwaved. I want their stuff to be searched. No, I don't need no stinking warrant. We're talking about a world where the concept of a Fourth Amendment and God-given rights and the right to keep and bear arms and to be free of illegal search and seizure is as foreign to the fake gods as the concept of love your neighbor, trust your neighbor, I can leave my doors unlocked, is to the world that it has replaced it. Which kingdom are we in? We were a hell of a lot closer to a kingdom of heaven on earth when we trusted our neighbor and loved one another and walked in obedience to his word than we are now, where we're so enlightened we don't need any of that stuff anymore. We have a hardcore view of reality. We don't have a Torah worldview. God isn't even welcome in the schools. Hasn't been for years. Let this mind be in you, not in your public schools, not in the United States of America, post-constitutional, where you're treated like a slave, like a criminal, where you're groped and microwaved and examined, and your stuff is looked at and stolen from you. And we don't need the rule of law. Well, unless, of course, you're Hitler, in which case you're above the rule of law. It all boils. You see, any way you slice it, this is the thing that's always fascinated me about Torah. And as we go through Torah, you'll hear me talk about, well, in a few weeks, Deuteronomy chapter 30, choose life. I've laid before you this day life and blessing, death and cursing. Therefore, choose life. We have a choice. It's a choice that's guaranteed by our Creator. You know what? That's the very same thing we're talking about when we hear words like, seek first the kingdom of heaven and all this stuff will be added to you. It's the very same concept we're talking about when we say, look, this feedback loop, this heel and toe circular relationship, good begets good, obedience begets blessing, which begets more obedience and more blessing. All of these things are ultimately about a choice of law, a choice of worldview, a choice of causal relationship, cause and effect. Which world are you going to be in? The world where everything gets worse and worse and worse and spirals downhill? Or the world where we say, hey, I choose life. I choose obedience. I choose to walk in obedience to Him. I'm going to avoid these fake gods. And I'm going to bring that crap into my house. And the problem is the following. This is, again, the reason why I mentioned I get so upset when I see the manipulation of people and the use of these tools and these technologies that we've developed that describe the mathematics of closed-loop feedback systems. Because once you can get people convinced that there is no God, His law doesn't matter, it's nailed to the cross, it's done away with, hey, He knows my heart, I'll bring some bunnies and eggs in there and I will I'll worship these fake gods. May take a while, because the cause and effect relationship sometimes has some lag in it. The consequences for an evil deed, well, they may not even fit the mold, because we don't even understand spiritual economics anymore. No wonder. We can literally walk the road to hell and not have a clue of how far down that road to a literal hell on earth we are. Well, okay, here's the simple thing. I look at the end of this line, the role of trust. That's the answer, right? If everyone would trust everyone else as we're supposed to, life would be good. Well, wait a minute. We know there's people that aren't trustworthy. They didn't grow up in, they don't live in this world. Can you see why it is we're still in exile, I ask? I like this line. This rabbi says, look, things are no different spiritually than they are with economics or other things in the world. Unless I place my trust in God, it always seems to me that reality is not based on covenant. It is non-covenantal in nature. All right, how can I alone try to reshape the world? Can I reshape the world? No, you can't. Can I come out? Can I walk in obedience? Oh, I know. How about it this way? Can I seek first the kingdom of Yah, and all these things will be added to me? I can't make somebody else obey. Now, that's what the world will tell us. They want to make you obey. They want to get rid of your God and force you to obey. Can't do that. I can come out, however. I can seek first His kingdom. I can choose, and I can walk in obedience for myself. And over time, understand that this obedience is a positive feedback loop and that it will alter perceptions and it will alter reality. But if I start thinking, hey, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? I prayed for it. I didn't get it. Sorry, I guess I won't do that anymore. I can't tell you folks how many times I have dealt with atheists and agnostics and other people saying, okay, seek and ye shall find. I quoted that once to a friend who was an atheist. And her response, she says, Mark, that pisses me off. Don't even say that to me. Seek and ye. Evidently, she thinks she sought and she didn't find. My comment, of course, and it's not going to fall on obedient ears, is maybe you didn't seek quite the right way. But you know and I know that it's perception that's going to alter the understanding of even how that particular response is received, right? You got to get there on your own terms. I can't make her see. I can't make her understand that if you're seeking and you're not finding, maybe it's because you're not seeking right. Maybe it's because you didn't, well, what does it say? Seek Him with your whole heart. Why would I seek Him with my whole heart if I don't think He exists? Well, there you go. If you truly believe He doesn't exist, it's going to be a little bit tougher to you, for you to see it. You heard me joke about the minimum necessary miracle and similar. All right, let's talk about one other aspect of this that is right here in the Torah portion as well that is key, because I'm looking at a second article that I think does a pretty good job of going from the individual and this idea of feedback loops, a lot of nerdy things I've laid out here, to, the bigger concept of why we are where we are today. This is a piece from another one of my favorites. I frequently read this fella from Britain, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. His article on Ekev is called Why Civilizations Fail. And he goes back and looks at a lot of history and a lot of great philosophers and stuff that I'm not going to necessarily go into some detail on. I'm going to just hit the high points. But he says it this way. The real challenge, you know, the real challenge of blessings, of the blessings of free enterprise. Look at America. Look at the things that obedience to God brought, right? The most productive, the most, at least at one point, free society on planet Earth. The real challenge, he writes, of a free society is not poverty, but affluence. It's not insecurity, but it's security. It's not slavery, but freedom. What's the real challenge of maintaining a free society? Well, we see it in Akev. Moshe springs this great surprise. And he quotes Deuteronomy 8, 11 through 19. Says this, and I think this is fabulous. Be careful, said Moshe, that you do not forget Yahuwah Eloheka. Otherwise, you eat, you're satisfied, you build fine houses, you settle down, you get your herds and flocks, positive feedback abounds, heel and toe, obedience begets blessing, you got everything you can possibly want. Maybe your heart gets to be a little bit proud and you forget Yahuwah and you say, my power and my hands, the strength of my arm, have brought me this great wealth. Well, he warned, if you forget Yahuwah Eloheka, I testify today, you'll surely be destroyed. Right back to the cycle of great civilizations, rise and fall. He puts it this way, look, you guys thought that 40 years of wandering out there in Bamidbar in the desert, the wilderness, you thought that was the real challenge? Once you get into the land and you conquer those bad Canaanites, you settle down, everything will be all, you know, sweetness and light. Truth is, that's when the real challenge not only will begin, but as we look at history, it did begin. It's precisely when all of your physical needs are met by the blessing that comes from spiritual obedience, then you have land and sovereignty and rich harvests and safe homes, right? You can leave your doors unlocked. Kids play in the streets. Nobody's going to bother them. Then the spiritual trial really commences. Look at the 60s. Okay, some of us, baby boomers, child of the 60s, remember those safe homes and so forth. Well, what happened? A lot of, free love, sex, drugs, rock and roll. You can go back and look at all the turmoil and recognize the destruction, essentially, of all of those things that were staid and no longer hip. They were cool. They weren't cool. It was cool to hate God. It was cool to do these various, it was cool to be nowadays, right? If God says something's okay, we say it's outlawed. If he says something is an abomination, we'll license it and mandate it. From transsexualism and transgenderism to, fill in the blanks. Bestiality isn't too far behind. You could probably set your watch by that one. Real challenge, he says, is not poverty, but it's affluence. It's not insecurity, but security. It's not slavery, but freedom. Moshe was literally, and he quotes some historians like Harvard historian Niall Ferguson, Moshe was giving an account of the decline and fall of civilizations. You can look at the Renaissance period in Italy. You can look at the Greeks and others. When you look at all of this and step back, then and only then do you begin to see the momentous project that the Book of Devarim, say the sages, was proposing. Now listen to this. He's talking about a positive feedback loop, right? You walk in obedience, blessing happens. Heel and toe, heel and toe. The creation of a society where children are taught the worldview, a Torah worldview, a positive relationship, a causal relationship, where the result is a society which does not forget Yah, does not adopt foreign gods, paganism, idolatry in its place and in his place. You have a society that therefore is capable of defeating the normal laws of the growth and decline of civilizations. All of this, they say, is astonishing. Of course, it hadn't happened yet. We know that if we read the end of the book, it talks about when the Torah is written on your hearts. I guess the point is, we ain't never going to do it. We can, if we seek him, we will find. We can invite him, give us eyes to see and ears to hear, and write the Torah on our hearts. But it's still necessary, in spite of the fact that you've got some people that have pagan Christmas and Easter traditions will tell you, oh, I don't need the Torah. The Holy Ghost wrote it on my heart. Right? You've heard my joke line on that one. There may be something that is telling you something, but it sure as hell ain't holy. If it's telling you that the Torah is done away with, nailed to the cross, you don't have to walk in obedience, it's not from him. And we don't recognize that if we have brought these idols into our house. If we think that the creator of the universe is so stupid that when he says he isn't going to change one yod or tittle, long as heaven and earth still exist, that he's a liar and the truth is not in him. Now, the rabbi that I'm looking at here, he summarizes it this way. And I would say, while there's some truth in this, I would draw some exception. He says it like this. Okay, how do we get to this place? How do we walk in this kind of obedience? By each person bearing and sharing responsibility for society as a whole. If society as a whole is corrupt and headed to hell, my response comes right out of Scripture too. Touch not the unclean thing. Be separate. Come out of her, my people. Moshe led a people out of a pagan, idolatrous, Pharaoh-loving Egypt. They didn't take responsibility for Egypt. They came out of it. They obeyed Yah in the process. But I do think the rest of what he says here is valuable. Each person needs to know the history, the Torah. We need to be able to see the cause and effect. We need to be able to watch, to follow our way through these feedback loops. Each individual needs to study and understand the Torah, the laws, the statutes, judgments, and commandments that govern the world, the universe, society, economics. It's all written down for us in genuine print. And furthermore, we need to teach our children so that they too become literate and articulate. Don't forget where you came from. Don't drift from the foundational principles that are written for us. And be strong. Society must be strong and of good courage in its faith. So I accept the general concepts, but the place where I draw the distinction is I can't be responsible for society as a whole. And if I start thinking that I can and that I can fix my neighbor, well, guess what? Pretty soon I'm a social justice warrior, and I've bought into the biggest lie of all. You can be like God. You will not die. I'm not God. I have a choice. Well, for me and my house, we can walk in obedience. We can come out. And in a world, basically, where I look at it today and I say, okay, let's see what's going on, right? We have an entire world that's forgotten him, that's teaching children that he's not even welcome. They're teaching children, you want to get ahead? Don't be like Trump. Don't honor your word. Be like Hitlery. You can get away with crime. Laws? Laws are for the little people. I want to be one of those that's above the law. Cause and effect, honoring your word, well, that's for rubes. That's for people who get taken advantage of. Again, it's all back to this choice and a worldview. Children, I will contend, are essentially blank slates. They want to learn. And we're told by Elohim that we have a responsibility to teach them his way. And if we let somebody else teach them something different, we're guilty. And the results we can see. People will perish. There's a little bit more in this Torah, and the pieces fit, the Torah portion, the pieces fit. One of the themes that shows up in here is Moshe warning people, look, you guys have made mistakes. Long as I've known you, let me tell you here, you have been a stiff-necked people. Moshe in his speech says, look, here's what happened in Horeb. Remember how you really torqued him off? Hey, how about the incident there at Mount Sinai and the golden calf? You remember that? You really torqued him off? You have been rebellious against Yahuwah from the day I knew you. You really torqued him off. Now, what's interesting, and this too is in this Torah portion, you notice that Moshe goes through the discussion of two sets of tablets, right? If you will, the law, the instruction that was written down by the hand of Yah on stone tablets, he brought them down. Moshe threw them against the ground because of the rebellion, the whoring, the idolatry of the people. Right? If it had been written on paper, we'd say the ink wasn't even dry. And what happened? Another 40 days and 40 nights back up on the mountain, another set of tablets. Does seem like we're seeing kind of a second coming, if you will, understanding. And at the point where he's given this speech, still, y'all have been rebellious from day after day. Stiff-necked people. Fast forward multiple thousands of years. We're still a stiff-necked people. And we're still in exile. So let's talk about where we are today and a little bit of the Haftorah portion, because it's the Haftorah portion that I will contend that really kind of helps to clarify all of this in terms of, you know, a whole different causal relationship and a whole different worldview. I'm looking towards the end of the portion here. This is chapter 10. It's a statement that sounds like something right out of the prophets, where we get an almost word-for-word repetition of this. But Moshe says it pretty well. Now, Israel, he says, what is it that Yahuwah, your El, requires of you? But to fear Yahuwah Eloheka, to walk, heel and toe, in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve Yahuwah Eloheka with all your heart and with all your soul, to keep for your good the commandments of Yahuwah and his statutes, which I command you this day. He keeps repeating this. The beauty of a closed-loop system, of course, folks, every time you go around through the loop, you see a repetition of the same things. Fear him, serve him, walk in obedience. So let's go to chapter 49 of the book of Yeshayahu, Isaiah, for a minute and talk a little bit about the Haftorah portion that I think does a fabulous job of summarizing this and making clear to us what we're referring to when we talk about a choice of law, a choice of kingdom. Seek first the kingdom of Yah. Seek to get out of a kingdom that has nothing to do, where he isn't even welcome, and the like. Now, this portion is also called one of the Haftorot of comfort. Comfort, comfort, my people. We had one of those a while back. And it begins at, let's just say, about verse 49:14 of Yeshayahu. Zion said, Yahuwah has forsaken me, and my Elohim has forgotten me. Now, there's a difference. I sometimes talk about cycles, right? There's a difference between this part of the cycle and that part of the cycle. You could argue that in the past, Israel, northern kingdom, or Judah, southern kingdom, or the people of Yah, maybe even people in America, would have said, you know, God has forgotten me. He has forsaken me. Nowadays, of course, you ask somebody in Hollywood, there is no God. Okay, they're not going to say he's forgotten me, forsaken me. It helped that as far as their parents were concerned, maybe he'd forgotten him. So the kid grows up thinking there isn't one. Can a woman, though, forget her nursing child, not have compassion on the son of her womb? Surely they may forget, yet I will not forget you, say the words in red from the prophet. See, I have inscribed you on the palms of my hands. Your walls are continued before me. Your son shall make haste. Destroyers, those who laid you waste, shall go away from you. Look up, see, look around, check out, see what you can see with your eyes. All these will gather together and they'll come to you. As I live, says Yahuwah, you will surely clothe yourselves with them as an ornament and bind them as a bride does. So there's a lot of interesting, comforting kinds of stuff here. Sounds like some time where things are getting better. We could say, okay, this is a prophecy, probably happened in the past, will happen again. All that's good. But so what? Tell me something about where we are now. Where are we today? How can we relate to how far out this is and what needs to happen so we can get there? How about this? Thus says Yahuwah, this is verse 22, behold, I'll lift my hand in an oath to the nations. I'll set up my standard for the peoples. They'll bring your sons in their arms, and their daughters, your daughters, will be carried on their shoulders. Kings will be your foster fathers. Queens are nursing mothers. They'll bow down to you with their faces to the earth and lick the dust at your feet. Then, now listen to this, then you shall know that Ani Yahuwah. That's the repeated promise, of course, right out of the book of Exodus and many, many, many other places throughout Scripture. They will know. They will not know that, no, I am the Lord. That really irritates me, as you know. They will know Ani Yahuwah. That's what he says. There's a difference there. Not just any old God calls himself capital L-O-R-D. A very specific one, the one that wrote this book for us, the one that wrote and showed and demonstrated and over and over and over again says, and then they will know that Ani, Ki Ani Yahuwah, I am who I say I am. Oh, isn't that the one that was born on December the 25th? Isn't, no, folks. If we don't even know his name, how do we claim that we yada him, right? This says there'll come a time when we'll know. And I read that as, hey, there's one of the essential distinguishing differences. But we don't even know that his name is not capital L-O-R-D, and that he didn't do away with his own word, and that all the things we have in fact been told that he did, or should have done if he was as smart as the men who changed his word and claimed to be the vicar of Christ on earth and all these other bogus things, how are we going to claim we know him? But it says here, then you will know that Ani Yahuwah, for they shall not be ashamed who wait for me. I guess it's helpful if we really know who it is we're waiting for, isn't it? Okay, there's more here, but as you probably know, if you're aware of where I'm headed, Deuteronomy 7 through 12, lots of stuff about idolatry. Lots of promises that if you walk in obedience, good stuff will happen. If you don't, you get kicked out. You'll be, the Hebrew word is shalak, to be put away, sent away for cause. We know that this happened. We know that if you look at Jeremiah 3, the two women of Yah, the two whoring wives, both of them, Northern Kingdom, Israel, Ahola, Southern Kingdom, Aholabah, both of them sent into exile. Jeremiah tells the story. Ezekiel 23 tells almost precisely the same story. And here we see a similar reference. This is the third witness. Comes through the prophet Yeshayahu, Isaiah, and it's in verse 50. And it says this. Now listen carefully here. Thus says Yahuwah, where is the Sefer Keratuta from your mother? The one that I gave her. Sefer Keratuta. Oh yeah, Deuteronomy 24 says that a man, when he shalaks a woman, sends her away, he's to give her a certificate of divorce, the Sefer Keratuta, and then she may go be another man's Isha, wife. If not, if she doesn't have this certificate, this written witness of the man who sent her away, who was her husband, she is still a husband. Now, this is why there's so much confusion about Matthew 5:32 and other places where Yeshua clarifies these things. And if people don't bother to read what the book says and they think it's done away with, or they get the Catholic stuff, oh, there's no reason, can't be done. Unless the Pope tells you, of course, that's okay. You can't divorce a woman. Well, excuse me, that's a lie. Deuteronomy 24 lays it out. Now, what does Yeshua say? You should not do that. It's because of the hardness of your hearts that this was even necessary. Well, okay, excuse me. It's because of the hardness of our hearts that we're still not in the Garden of Eden. It's because of the hardness of our hearts that the book didn't end at Genesis 3. It's because of the hardness of our hearts that all this other crap is still coming down on us and we're still in exile. So I hear people say, well, then we shouldn't do it. Well, we shouldn't have done it in the first place. But let's not kid ourselves. We're still stiff-necked. We're still hard-hearted. And the reason he wrote this book for us is because, hey, he's given us a way to deal with that. So it's kind of silly to tell people you can't be divorced, while at the same time they'll tell you the law's done away with anyway. Which is it? Right? I want to read what it says and understand what it is that it's telling us about where we are today and what we need to do. Because he did know the end from the beginning. He had a plan. He knew we were stiff-necked, hard-hearted, fake, lying, can't-be-trusted people who were going to do the same thing over and over again, and we're going to go into exile, and here we are. And he had a plan. So let's figure out what we need to do to get back on track for his plan. Hey, here it says. So, where is the certificate, the Sefer Keratuta, from your mother, whom I have put away, whom I have shalak? Now, that's a Hebrew twisting, right? The word is shalaked. The word is shalak, I put the ED, the English ending on it. So just so we understand, that's not good grammar. All right. Which of my creditors is it to whom I've sold you? Look, it's because of your own iniquities, your own Torahlessness. You have sold yourselves. For your iniquities, you've sold yourselves. You get it? I didn't do this to you. You made a choice. Choose life. You didn't. Choose to walk in obedience, you didn't. Choose to serve me and fear me and be my bride, my wife, to do the things that a son does, right? Any metaphor you pick, he's got a parable that lays it out. And any way you look at it, you blew it. I blew it. We all blew it. We walked in rebellion. Our fathers walked in rebellion because we're still stiff-necked. For your own iniquities, you sold yourselves. For your own transgressions, your mother has been put away. Why? When I came, was no one. No man. Why? When I called, was there no one to answer? Is my hand shortened? I can't redeem? Do I have no power to deliver? Indeed, with my rebuke, I dry up the seas. I make the rivers a wilderness. Fish stink, because there ain't no water. They die of thirst. I clothe the heavens with blackness. I make sackcloth their covering. Yahuwah Eloheka has given me the tongues of the learned, that I should know how to speak, a word in season to him who's weary. He awakens me morning by morning, awakens my ear to hear as the learned. Yahuwah Eloheka has opened my ear. I was not rebellious, nor did I turn away. I gave my back to those who struck me. Now, if you see this in print, you notice that the translators have capitalized a lot of this, and wonder who he's talking about, right? Maybe we have an idea. Maybe some folks don't quite see it, but it does certainly seem like he is referring to the Redeemer, the Mashiach. I didn't hide my face from shame and spitting, my cheeks to those who plucked out my beard. For Yahuwah Eloheka will help me, therefore I will not be disgraced. I've set my face like a flint. I know that I shall not be ashamed. He is near who justifies me. Who will contend with me? Let's stand together. Who is my adversary? Let him come near me. Surely Yahuwah Eloheka will help me. Who will condemn me? And here's the verse that I'm kind of leading up to. This is the place where I think, all right, we've seen a number of references. We've seen a number of things that historically we understand, at least if we have the right Torah-obedient worldview, we do. We understand that he knew the end from the beginning. He's laid these things out for our good. Great. Verse 10 says it this way. This is, again, Isaiah 50, verse 10. Who among you fears Yahuwah? Who obeys the voice of his servant? Who walks in darkness and has no light? Let him trust. Remember this trust? This trust is a feedback loop thing. If I don't believe he exists, how can I trust in him? On the other hand, if I know him, how can I not trust in him? Let him trust in the name of Yahuwah and rely upon his El. Look, all of you who kindle a fire. Now he's changing gears here. Listen to this part. All of you who kindle a fire, you encircle yourselves with sparks. You walk in the light of your fire, right? Like the power and the might of your hand. And then the sparks that you have kindled. Well, this, he says, you can have from my hand. You shall lie down in torment. Listen to me, he continues. Verse 51. Chapter 51, you who follow after Torah observance, righteousness, you who seek Yahuwah, look to the rock from which you were hewn, and the hole of the pit from which you're dug. Look to Abraham, your father, Sarah, who bore you, for I called him alone, and I blessed him and increased him. Okay, the rest of this is, again, more comfort. And it's an indicator of things we need to look forward to. But I'm going to point to just a few verses here as we start to kind of wrap up this. I'm going to go back to that one that I've already read. And I want to suggest that when it comes to how do we get back to this Torah observant worldview, all right? I've had people tell me before, Mark, you talk about come out of her over and over again every week. Well, yeah, because it's the solution for this part of the cycle, I will suggest. Touch not the unclean thing, be separate. But the question, of course, is always, well, there's more to it, right? How? Who among you, and I read this again, right? Who among you fears Yahuwah, who obeys the voice of his servant? A, if we know him, if we love him, if we claim we love him, if you love me, he says, keep my commandments. There's a loop here. There is a heel and toe. There's an encirclement. In other words, the whole concept of Ikev at this point combines cause and effect. It says, look, right? If you, I'll tell you what, folks, having now a left leg that is pretty well locked in place, I will suggest that sometimes we forget the miracle of walking. You realize how hard it is? I know I worked as an engineer to design a robot that can walk. That has balance, it has gyros, it has feedback loops, and trust me, there's lots and lots and lots of incredible feedback loops that stabilize your body when you put heel and toe, and walk. And it is a technological achievement that man couldn't even duplicate up until literally just recent years to build a robot that can walk the way a man walks. No wonder, you know, when you step back and look at Akev and the causal relationships, that if we really, truly understand this concept of because you walk in obedience, these blessings come, and the loop, the feedback loop, builds an entire society from that. It's kind of astounding. We don't see it. And yet at the same time, because it's a feedback loop, it's very simple, and it's very almost impossible to see. If you break the loop, all of a sudden it doesn't work anymore. I glossed over this, but I'm going to suggest that when it comes to the adversary, right, he comes but to kill and destroy. Look at the world today. If you can destroy a people's worldview, if you can destroy a people's worldview, you can destroy their world. Look and see where we stand today, literally on the brink of war, possibly nuclear war. We stand on the brink of an economic destruction with the biggest debt load in all of human history. And so many things that have gotten to be crises of biblical proportions. How do we deal with it? How do we come out of it? How to be separate? Who among you fears Yahuwah? Who obeys the voice of his servant? Let's cut to the chase. I want to read one more thing. Okay, I made some notes here. I didn't talk much about the news yet. By the way, if there's some questions, we'll do that in a few minutes, because there's a lot that we probably ought to talk about specifics in terms of the world and this idea of where we are. But I had some notes, and I kind of skipped over this. Didn't fit when I went through it the first time. Question came up online this morning. Do we live in a free society? Well, arguably, at one point we did. Is it possible to have freedom of religion? Isn't that what the First Amendment says, freedom of religion? Well, not exactly. Huh? Am I denying that? You betcha. If you tell me we have a society that has freedom of religion, I'll tell you, pardon me for being blunt, but you're an idiot. You don't understand. Oh, really? Come on, isn't that mean-spirited, Mark? We do not have freedom of religion, folks. What we have is a law that once said, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Isn't that the same thing? Well, not if you understand it. Because this law was made in obedience to a people who unanimously agreed, we hold these truths to be self-evident. In other words, there was no doubt. Now, they may or may not have known his name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, or the Lord, or called him Jesus Christ, or different things. However, the book of Deuteronomy, the most quoted book during the founding age, it was very clear. It was understood. The common law of Britain was elemental. It was, in fact, based right smack on Deuteronomy, on the Torah. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not murder. There's a slight difference, but basically they agreed it was wrong. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not covet. Whole lot of principles that once upon a time were considered universal, undeniable. Can you have freedom of religion if I say my religion is that I worship Molech and I want to sacrifice your son to my fake god? Do you see the disconnect? If we all agree that there is a God and that the God who gave us liberty gave us life and that it's about his Torah and that it's about honest weights and measures and all those things that are written there in genuine print, fine. But if I start telling you, oh, Islam and Muhammad the prophet and Sharia law are just as good as your Torah, you've broken the loop. There is no positive feedback. If my God says, I will kill you if you don't worship him, I'll tell you one thing. He sure as hell isn't the God who says, choose life. I have laid before you this day life and blessing, death and cursing. I have given you a choice. Seek first the kingdom, my kingdom. If you tell me, I got a God that says you don't have a choice. You will worship transgenderism. You will vaccinate your children. You will teach them what I tell you to teach them. You have no choice. Well, there may be a spirit there, but it sure as hell ain't holy. You cannot have freedom of religion in a society that will succeed in doing anything except destroying itself. You can have freedom of worship, And the choice is whether I choose to worship the God on a, sun god day or his Sabbath. Doesn't kill me when somebody gets the day wrong. Now, it might, in the long run, affect society if he starts taking the time of Passover and worshiping it with bunnies and eggs. And maybe that has to do with the reason why we saw what was done in ancient Canaan, when it was, in fact, being purged. And it never was completely cleaned out. It's part of the reason why I suggest that today, the final part, as we build towards the greater Exodus and all these things that are to come, the answer is to come out of her and be separate. Not going to try to change the world, just going to come out and do separate things. And at some point, I know that he will be the one that will come back and change the world. It's not my might, my strength that's going to build this new world. Which brings me now to where I want to end. Look and see what's going on in a society where freedom of religion and egalitarianism and any god's as good as any other god, your god's not welcome in the schools anyway, right? You can teach Islam in the schools. But you cannot teach that there is one God and that his name is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and that he gave us certain rules for living. Here are some comments. Just in the last week, all of these things, all of these were stories. I didn't even do most of these stories because they just irritate you and you basically say, oh, come on, are people really this stupid? Of course they are. There's some school boards that are eliminating the name Lynch because it might have racist connotations. How dare you have a school named Lynch? Well, you know, Joe Lynch, Fred Lynch, Seymour Lynch. These were people that probably did something that once upon a time was considered good. But nowadays, of course, we don't talk about that anymore. There's a movement in the South that people are concerned about because there are people that are saying maybe the South should separate this time for sure. How about this one? I just was shown this not long ago. There's a gummy bear called a black cow. Achtung, verboten, you will not have a candy called black cow. That is racist. Okay, you remember how it was racist? Was it the Washington Redskins? I'm not a big football fan anyway, but Washington Redskins became a racist term. How dare you say that? Gonna fix that, gonna change that. And then I saw this. Kind of shows you hypocrisy writ large, right? Stanford University is offering a fall course this year, taught by a scumbag idiot. Not going to name the so-called professor, but the professor is going to teach a class on, are you sitting down? Eradicating whiteness. Now, it's racist to use a term like lynch, or to have a candy called a black cow, or a football team named Redskins, but it's not racist to talk about eradicating whiteness or killing whitey, or basically destroying maleness. Did you know that sperm counts over the last 25 years worldwide are down 50%? They're not just eradicating whiteness and maleness. They are eradicating the human race. You look at this stuff and you go, are you kidding me? How stupid can people be? Answer, well, stiff-necked and more stupid than you can possibly imagine. They're teaching kids a complete different worldview. They're teaching that cause and effect doesn't even matter anymore. And they're literally so dumbed down, they're not going to get it. The end here, the end game is complete and total destruction. It's complete and total destruction of a society and a worldview that was obedient to Yah. Response, same. Come out of her, my people. So let me end with this. This is from Isaiah 51, verse 7. And the prophet, writing for, the words in red, the words of Yah says this, listen to me, you who know the Torah, you Zadikim, you who know righteousness. And the word there isn't just listen. In the Hebrew, it's Shema. It's hearken, hear and obey. Bigger, and that's part of the key. In other words, sometimes, folks, we even read the words of the prophets. We got to go back and say, what does the Hebrew really say? It's deeper. Maybe this explains how come sometimes people don't quite get it. This isn't just listen. Oh, yeah, I heard. Nope. Hear and obey. You who know, yada, righteousness. You people in whose heart is my Torah. All right, now we're talking. What is he really telling us to do in these times? Do not fear the reproach of men, nor be afraid of their insults. Wait a minute. They're going to tell you they want to eradicate whitey. That if you are a man who actually believes there's a difference, that God made them male and female. Oh, that's politically incorrect. That's verboten. If you think it's stupid to not have a candy called a black cow, but it's okay to have a bitch. Oop, did I say that? A witch? A Hitlery? A woman who is guilty of treason and has committed high crimes and misdemeanors, the likes of which? Well, let's just put it this way. No one in the White House today, even though they're being investigated, has committed. If you can't see those distinctions, I guess you're primed, ripe for what's coming. Listen to me, you who know righteousness and in whose heart is my Torah. Do not fear the reproach of these cretinous, lying haters of God and haters of all that is righteous and true. Do not fear their reproach, nor be afraid of their insults.
You racist, you! You homophobe, you! You Islamophobe, you! How dare you diss the fake gods!
Don't be afraid of their crap. Don't be afraid of their insults, because the moth, it says, will eat them up like a garment, and the worm will eat them like wool. But my righteousness will be ha'olam forever, and my salvation from generation to generation. The entire rest of this section, as I'm looking across these pages of these words of comfort from Yeshayahu, awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of Yahuwah. Awake, awake, stand up, you who've drunk at the hand of Yahuwah the cup of his fury. Next page. See, I've taken out of your hand the cup of trembling, the dregs of my cup of fury. We talk about these frequently. The whoring wife, the wife who is still in rebellion, who is still in exile because of that rebellion. He will comfort. Return to me, he says. It's the singular repeated lesson of all of these things. Awake, awake, return, make teshuvah. And eventually we hear this, I've taken out of your hand that cup of trembling. You no longer have to drink it. You've been redeemed. Understand. And having done all of this, return. How about chapter 52, verse 11? Depart, depart, go out of there. Touch not the unclean thing. Go out from the midst of her. Be clean, you who bear the vessels of Yahuwah, for you shall not go out with haste, nor go by flight, for Yahuwah will go before you, and the Elohim of Israel will be your rear guard. So, in other words, again, lots and lots of very comforting stuff in a time which is about as discomforting as it can be. As we look at the world and see the nastiness, and as we see how close we stand to, an economic meltdown, which would, of course, kill a whole lot of people, or a nuclear meltdown, which would, of course, kill a whole lot of people, or a destruction of, whether we're talking about fertility, or the human immune system, or the poisons that are being put out by the Monsatans of the world that people are drinking, and not understanding in their ignorance, which will kill a whole lot of people. We're at a place where I can't help but think we're going to see a whole lot of people die. And that's a sad thing. And it would be great if we could fix it. But ironically, and probably we can't, what we can do is do what we're told to. Blow the shofar. Separate ourselves. Touch not the unclean thing. By your fruit, show them the way that they ought to walk. Some might do it. Some will. But if we start thinking we can command them the way they want to command us, we fall into the trap. It's about a worldview. It's about literally choosing a whole different worldview and understanding that the worldview we have to have, given what's coming, is a Torah-obedient worldview. And it includes a whole lot of stuff that is literally anathema. And I tend to rail a lot against the whore church and the fact that there is a church. And I'm not going to name the names. You know the names. You see these people on TV that are preaching things that are ultimately leading to destruction. And they've been preaching fake gods and idolatry for a long, long time. Awake, awake. come out of her. Touch not the unclean thing. This is a time where we're going to have to lead by example, and we're going to have to be ready for what is not only coming, but very, very close at hand on so many fronts. One or two more things. I kind of alluded to this last night, but I'll mention it here just by way of some practical stuff, because it's been on my heart. It's been a concern that I've had. I look at the situation with North Korea, and I look at the fact that what's been set up here by the neocons is such an incredible deception. It strikes me as more than a bit, disgusting that for 8 years the Obama regime told us and the so-called intelligence community produced reports saying North Korea is not a threat. They can't possibly hurt the United States. Don't worry about their nuclear program. Don't worry about their missile program. Hey, isn't it funny that the very same Clinton regime that sold the communist Chinese the interstage technology to allow them to develop ICBMs that worked, and eventually, who knows how much of that got to the North Koreans, is the same that was essentially lying and telling people, don't worry about it. Don't worry, your pretty little heads, peace and security. What can the North Koreans do? And then all of a sudden, just in the last months, isn't this amazing? Out of nowhere. Now, all of a sudden, the missiles, and by the way, they launched satellites into orbit 2 years ago. Hey, if you can launch a satellite into orbit, folks, you can send a payload anywhere on Earth, pretty much. We're talking just a difference in trajectory. But once you can send a payload high enough and fast enough, it's not like, oh, it can't get to New York. Yes, it can. Who are we kidding? People have been lied to, inherited lies from their fathers. So it bugs me that, North Korea is not a threat up until, about January of this year, and then, booga, 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 they're going to kill you. Yes, all of a sudden, bang, 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 now they can do this stuff that we said they couldn't do for years. And, did you hear it? Just this same week, now they've got miniaturized nuclear warheads. Who could have thought of that? And guess what? They can launch an EMP. Indeed, they probably could have years ago. And they could take down the power grid, and they could destroy America, and let's not kid ourselves. Booga, booga, booga. Maybe now we need to go nuke them. Maybe now we need the nuclear war. Couldn't get it started with Syria, tried hard. Couldn't get it started in the Middle East. Now, how about Ukraine? Well, maybe. How about in Russia? Can we poke the bear? Poke, poke, poke. Putin, you ready to nuke us yet? Somebody please nuke us. We are pushing the buttons all over the world. Come on, why won't somebody nuke us? Can you see the pattern? Good grief. I have this sense, and I pray that I'm wrong, but I have this sense that once the bear has been set up here and the nuclear threat has been raised from North Korea and China and everywhere else, eventually somebody will do it. And hey, if they don't, just maybe there's a deep state actor in Washington, D.C., at Langley or Foggy Bottom or somewhere, who will do it for them. Maybe call it maybe launch a cyber attack, take down the power grid, and then blame the dreaded, pick a villain. Putin, Ruskies, China, North Korea. If the plan all along was to bring down the power grid and use that as an excuse to cover up the inevitable economic meltdown, doesn't it seem amazing that all of a sudden the North Koreans have been set up as the perfect foil for all of that? What am I suggesting? I'm suggesting that the economic meltdown is inevitable. It's going to happen. Absolutely, positively, will happen. When? Could it be tomorrow? You betcha. Could it be any time in the next few months, 2 years? Sure. Do I think the likelihood is pretty good that it's going to be this year, before the fall? I would say it's a real possibility. Next year, the odds go up. It's called a cumulative probability, and it rises over time. But it's going to happen. We don't know when. Is the Federal Reserve going to step forward and say, hey, you know, when you use fake money and you build an entire world system based on dishonest abominations before Yah, this is always going to happen? Hell no, they're not going to say that. You know that, so do I. Do the communist Chinese want to be your world reserve currency provider? You betcha. When all of this comes to pass, are we going to see a blame shift? Going to blame the guy in the White House? You betcha. All I'm suggesting is the following, folks. There is maximum ugly, and it's prepped and ready to go. And we need to be prepared on all kinds of fronts. And it's still all about a worldview and a choice of law. And if we want his protection through what's coming, and we need his protection through what's coming, we're going to have to begin making the choices now. And time draws really, really short on that score. So I really can't in good conscience, go a week without at least pointing out where we are in the world and how poised on so many fronts things are for the inevitable to happen, and why it's therefore more important than ever that we learn to walk in obedience. Because if you want to have a prayer, there's only one that you want to pray to. Okay, any other? Okay, got a question.
Has he addressed the coming signs, August 21st, total eclipse, and September 23rd, stars, and another total eclipse in 7 years, as well as 40-day count from the total eclipse?
Okay, so all kinds of interesting numbers.
Compared to the Jonah one.
Yeah, okay, to lots of warnings. I am always a little bit more cautious on this score. So the question, if you didn't hear it on the recording, was, okay, look, got this total solar eclipse coming up on August 21. Count forward 40 days to the time that, about 30 days later actually includes Yom Teruah, the Day of Trumpets, and the beginning of the 10 days of, as they're called, awe, leading up to Yom Kippur. And when you put those 40 days together, it comes out to be pretty close to the beginning of, well, the fall feast and then later Sukkot. And I got to admit, when you see numbers like 40 days and 40 nights, and when you see numbers like time in the wilderness and Moshe up on the mountain and what Yeshua did and so forth, that 40 number does kind of stick out to you. So I do not fault those who then try to claim, okay, all of these signs mean X is going to happen. I will contend that it's a little bit easier to say X is going to happen when we look back than when we look forward. So I'm always reluctant to say that on this day something will happen and, it's going to be there. And that's not my style. My style is to say, be aware, be ready, blow the shofar, and know that it'll happen when it happens. We're supposed to wait on Yahuwah. We're supposed to know in whom we trust. We're supposed to be found walking in obedience whenever it is. And, the end of the book tells us to stand, having done all to stand, to be overcomers, and so forth. So I'm going to simply put it this way. I do think the numbers are really fascinating. September the 23rd is my Roman birthday. So I always find that interesting when you tend to say, oh, isn't that funny? I do know that I expect that there will be things that will happen in association with the fall feast. It makes logical Torah sense. But I am not quite willing to go out on a limb and say, thus spoke Yahuwah, because I haven't heard such. But when I see the patterns, I can't deny that, he is the kind of Elohim who puts these patterns and he puts these warnings there for a reason. So I would certainly say this, if nothing else, look at these things that are happening and say to yourself, I better get ready. I better get ready. Better late than never. It's already getting fairly late. I don't know if that's a right answer, if that's a complete answer to the question or not. I think in this case there's a better case to be made for some of the things that are shaping up now than maybe we've seen in the past with the so-called blood moons and so forth, which I don't doubt are, they're part of a pattern. When you understand that these things fit together, it's kind of natural that some of the patterns would tend to repeat like that. And I do look at the world and the economics, as I talk about this stuff every week. Things are coming to a head. That part is inevitable. And we know that the coming meltdown is truly going to be of biblical proportions. So it makes sense that these things would be consistent with Scripture and that they would be written about. And that, as a prayerful people, as a people who walk in obedience, sometimes he can, in fact, as he did with Nineveh, decide to put off the inevitable a while longer. So I'm not going to try to prejudge or guesstimate what's happening other than just to say, as always, the proper response is, come out of her, my people. Be prepared. Be ready. Be ready to stand and to be found doing his work whenever it is that he decides to return. If anything, though, I do tend to think it's going to get uglier before it gets better. That's just me. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is true too. For those that are inclined to just on a purely astronomical scale to see things, the claim is that the coming Perseids meteor shower. Now, there are actually a number of regular meteor showers that happen every year. They're associated with comets that pass through this vicinity of space where we find ourselves orbiting. And that you can see these meteors, and some of the astronomical types are saying, hey, this is supposed to be the brightest Perseids in, well, at least a long, long time. I guess that means we're getting closer to the center of wherever that comet passed. I can't help but think the moon is also going to be really bright. So how good it'll be, I'm not sure, because generally you see more meteors against the dark sky. But if you're inclined and you're up, especially before the moon comes up, take a look. And maybe it'll be something interesting. Yeah, so the moon will be up late. We can all stay up late and take a look. Okay, no other questions? All right, let us then close with prayer. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad. Abba, we thank you for your blessings. We thank you for your provision. We thank you for your word. We thank you for the technology and the chance to gather together the way that we are and to hear and speak and to let iron sharpen iron. We pray that you'd give us eyes to see and ears to hear, that you would guide us. We know that there are some things coming down, and they are, were we not obedient, some would say they're scary. Abba, help us to truly trust in you, to walk in obedience, and to know that you are our strength, that the things we have are by your blessings. Help us to enter into that feedback loop of blessing and obedience, to walk before you in a way that is pleasing to you, heel and toe, step by step, to veer neither to the right nor to the left. Father, we lift up our loved ones as well. We do have loved ones who are sometimes walking in rebellion. We live in a world that's walking in rebellion. We pray that you'd guide us and help us to do the things that we need to be doing, to be good and faithful servants unto you and leave the rest to you. To know that just as Elijah wasn't sure who else was listening to his message, that there are those who are yours, who seek to be called by your name. And whether we know about them or not, they're out there. So we pray that you would bring those to us. We know there's a harvest coming. We could use more hands in the places that we are. Help us to be where we need to be and bring those to us and bring us together with those who would be a blessing to one another. And would help us to be ready and to walk and stand through what is coming. Heal our land, heal our communities, heal our families, heal our houses, we pray. Help us to make teshuva, to return to you, to be counted worthy to escape these things that are coming. Father, we thank you for your word, for your truth, for having sent your word to us and made flesh. For having redeemed us and brought us out of bondage by a mighty hand. And we thank you for the things that are yet to come. All this we ask in your set-apart name, for you are our King, our Savior, our Redeemer. Yahuwah Zevuot, Yahuwah Vitzivenu, Yahuwah Zediknu, Yahuwah Nisi. Hallelujah. And we thank you, Father, for your healing. Amen.